Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison's monthly meeting. Our speaker today is Ken Haydar. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you. Well, earlier today, I gave a talk to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society that touched on similarities between parts of Quakerism in North America today, and also on aspects of Quaker history during its first 300 years. But I wanted to focus today on something that I discovered in the course of preparing that talk, which I hadn't been familiar with, which is that the Quakers today in North America, the Religious Society of Friends, open parenthesis, Quakers, close parenthesis, actually function as five distinct and separate denominations, all calling themselves the Religious Society of Friends. And I'll quote Lyndon Johnson, who said in the context of politics, if you can't walk into a room and know who's for you and who's against you, get out of politics. So this is an opportunity to be more knowledgeable about who it is that is a Quaker. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick up the thread back in the year 1827, when there was a split within Quakerism between folks who wanted to retain the traditional silent meeting, or unprogrammed meeting as it's now called, and folks who wanted to change it and add elements that were found in other Protestant denominations. And the latter group called themselves the Orthodox. I see that as a little ironic. They were the ones who wanted change. But history also tells us.
Direction of other Orthodox.
The terms like liberal and Orthodox and even universalist have a totally different meaning in the context of Quakerism. It was not connected with, like the Russian or Greek Orthodox churches. It was it meant Orthodox in a more, well, I love this pun I'm coming up with, Catholic with a small c sense. Now, I started to say that these people call themselves Orthodox, and I was immediately reminded that at the time of the Russian Revolution, a minority of people at a large meeting called themselves the Bolsheviks, which means the majority, when they weren't the majority. And they left the, in fact, majority calling themselves the Mensheviks. And so calling yourself Orthodox in this context, I thought, was a political maneuver.
What's the definition?
In this context, it simply means people who wanted to bring into Quakerism formally trained ministers, sermons, readings from the Bible, singing hymns, the same as you would find at other Protestant denominations. And all this is occurring, as I say, in the 1820s.
Liturgy? Did they want to bring in liturgy?
Well, what I've described is liturgy, basically.
Yeah. What's the dictionary definition?
Of orthodoxy is right teaching.
The dictionary definition of orthodoxy is irrelevant here because it would give you a generic meaning and not the specific meaning within the context of Quakerism. What it means is it was attached to these specific changes that folks wanted, some folks wanted, about half the Quakers in North America and most of the Quakers in England. And it was pretty much England, North America, and the Caribbean where you found Quakers in that day and age. And what happened at that point, as I mentioned earlier today, was there was a split. It was pretty much down the middle. In terms of numbers, and in every monthly meeting, either the Orthodox or the folks who opposed these changes, who became known as Hicksites after Elias Hicks, would leave that meeting, found a new meeting of their own, and maybe even build a meeting house. Philadelphia has historical meeting houses that grew out of this so-called Hicksite separation. So now you have the Hicksites who are worshiping in the old fashion that George Fox himself would have been familiar with, and you have the Orthodox who are proceeding along. And there was a socioeconomic flavor to this. The wealthier folks kind of like the Orthodox in the Quaker sense changes. Well, about a couple of decades later, there's a second split away from the Orthodox. And this time they're called the Wilburites. And the Orthodox are now known as the Gurneyites. And the Gurneyites were named after Joseph John Gurney, who's an Englishman, but who came, among other things, came to America and fought to retain these changes, these Orthodox changes. Wilbur, surname, was a chap who basically didn't like this, and he wasn't so much a leader in the same way that Hicks was, as I understand it, but just his name got associated with that split. So now you have three groups. A little later on, and we're going through the 1800s at this point, there's a third group, and they break from the Orthodox. I should backpedal a second. The Wilburites had a different agenda and different sets of reasons for splitting with the Orthodox, but one of them was to return to the former manner of worship. The Hicksites kept it. The Wilburites first stayed within Orthodoxy, and then they moved and they founded a separate grouping.
Why did they join in with the
Hicksites? You're getting ahead of us. At this point, it would probably be because when you get to really real theological minutia, there were still differences between them. That is the simple answer. Now, the conservatives decided not only did they want to get back to the original form of worship, they wanted to get back to the original form of dress and the original form of language, thee, thou, and thy. Okay? And so now you've got four groups. And when you get to the late 1800s and the turn of the century, around 1900, there's a movement throughout Protestantism, the evangelical movement. There are a lot of evangelicals in America today who are under the impression that their religion is the same as the religion of the founding fathers and the pilgrim fathers before them, and it isn't. Their specific collection of beliefs really grew up on the prairie in North America in the second half of the 1800s. But there's this movement within Protestantism. Now, I don't know, because it frankly didn't interest me, whether the emergence of evangelical Quakers resulted from Orthodox Quakers deciding they wanted to move in that direction, or evangelicals entering Quaker monthly meetings, or congregations in other words, and helping to move it in that direction. I suspect the latter, but that would be pure speculation on my part. I just don't know. We do know that this happened. So now there are five groups, I believe. Now, eventually, for reasons that immediately came to Mary's mind, bulk of the Wilburites kind of hooked up again with the Hicksites. And now we're down to four groups, but nothing was simple. And there was a husband and wife named Bean, B-E-A-N, and they decide, and they're living in, I believe it was Indiana, and they decide that their monthly meeting is getting way too little evangelical for their taste. And they expressed that view, and they were summarily invited to leave. They wind up in California, found their own meeting, I mean, just this couple. And so you have the Beanites, and today, this is the lay of the land. Principally west of the Rockies, but in that general neck of the woods, are a whole bunch of liberal Quaker I'll explain that in a moment. Independent monthly meetings. They correspond with one another, but there's no national organization that oversees their affairs. Then you have across America the balance of 30% of the Quakers today who are liberal Quakers, and their monthly meetings are affiliated with the Friends General Conference. And Roberts Court monthly meeting, Madison monthly meeting, is affiliated with that national organization. These are the folks who are most liberal and progressive in terms of politics and in terms of accepting as members folks who are not necessarily Protestant theists. Just as Unitarian Universalists have for probably generations now accepted and embraced the concept of members who are hyphenated twice, not only the hyphen between Unitarian and Universalist, but also Buddhist UUs or Jewish UUs or Wiccan UUs or humanist or simply non-theist Unitarian Universalist. So in recent decades, the liberal Quaker meetings have increasingly welcomed folks who do not, as the Quakers had originally, embrace a belief in God. This is still seen by some members of those as odd, because they are themselves theistic. My read is that the proportion of humanists among the liberal Quakers isn't as high as it is across the nation among Unitarian Universalists, but they are there, and they are just as accepting of the concept of people sitting next to one another on Sunday having very different views, and not necessarily the historical views of the early Quakers, Universalists, and Unitarians. Then the Orthodox folks persist today. They represent about 35%, give or take, of the numbers. They are definitely proud of their Protestant theist heritage, and in many respects, because they do not have unprogrammed meetings, the old traditional style of meeting, they, in my mind, are probably closer to the Methodists today in being very progressive, by and large, on social issues, but maintaining a theist-Protestant tradition as such. You also have, and their national organization is called the Friends United Meeting. And unlike the Friends General Conference, which is pretty much that, it's a coming together to share views and common concerns, the Friends United Meeting is more of a central body overseeing and maintaining uniformity within the monthly meetings that belong to it. Almost all the remaining Quakers, again, in North America today, this picture varies greatly when you're on another continent. These are the evangelicals, and their national organization is called the, if I'm getting it correct, the Friends Evangelical Church International. Note the word church as opposed to meeting house or society or something along those lines. My understanding is that their views, or their theological views, are probably closest to the Southern Baptists. They, some of them embrace biblical literalism. I haven't delved into them in greater detail. Let me mention the last extant group. My understanding is that there are fewer than 1,000 conservative Quakers still here today. They are found in meetings in Indiana, Ohio, and North Carolina. And again, there's no national organization, but they're in close correspondence with one another. Now, all of this is not to say that these boundary lines are hard and fast. One of the largest Quaker monthly meetings in the U.S., other than the one over on Roberts Court, which is fairly large, is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, surprise, surprise. And it, like some meetings with a large membership in most cases, but not necessarily, actually is affiliated with both the Friends General Conference, the Liberal Quakers, and the Friends United Meeting, the Orthodox Quakers. And I believe that relations between those two groups, even though they have separate approaches to philosophy and theology, are perfectly cordial. The American Friends Service Committee is not denominational beyond being Quaker, and there's a group, and if I'm getting its name correctly, it's the Friends Legislative Council, which is basically a lobbying group in Washington, D.C., and its agenda and the agenda of, say, oh, I don't know, the Dane County Democrats would not be all that far apart on issues like peace and equality and so forth. Now, a lot of these differences are reflected in history. It was the Hicksites who, en route to the present age, founded Swarthmore College. It was Hicksites disproportionately who founded most of the older Friends schools, secondary schools, primary and secondary schools that exist today. There are many schools. If memory serves, Moses Brown was not the Hicksite Foundation; it was an Orthodox foundation. But that's exceptional. It is one of the older and better known and very good Friends schools. The Orthodox, so-called, well, they were the Orthodox, and then they were the Gurneyites, and now they're the Orthodox again, were the ones who founded Earlham and Haverford colleges. Most of the small colleges around America today were in fact founded by the evangelical Quakers. If you have a ministry, you need places to train them, and many of those schools originated as basically theological seminaries for Quaker ministers. The evangelicals and the Orthodox were both small evangelical and fairly active internationally, such that about half of all people who call themselves Quakers today are Kenyans. This parallels a phenomenon in the Anglican Communion, where a majority of Anglicans today are Africans resident in one of the former British colonies, and in both cases as a result of missionary work. Quintessential who I thought all the Quakers were 6 months ago, before I started looking into all of this in greater depth, would probably, the liberal Quaker, would be Joan Baez. Her parents became Quakers when she was 8. They were living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I don't know if she's still active, but my understanding is that she was affiliated with one of the independent monthly meetings out in California. And that style, you know, her interest, her concerns reflect reasonably well, I think, those held throughout the liberal Quaker community, whether independent or affiliated with the Friends General Conference. The Orthodox Quakers have produced, the style of the Orthodox Quakers, I would associate more with Herbert Hoover. Now, he was actually raised in an evangelical Quaker meeting, as best I can determine it, but I think his worldview probably coincided more closely with the Orthodox Quaker tradition. Again, definitely Protestant, definitely theist. Whittier College was founded by the evangelicals. Richard Milhouse Nixon was raised as an evangelical Quaker and attended Whittier College. I entered looking at questions of who exactly the Quakers are with all these different national organizations. And when I made that discovery, it answered lots of questions I had back as a political science student many years ago about how Richard Nixon was a Quaker. That's how.
That was something mystifying.
Yeah. Of all the things that I've discovered in the course of doing additional reading, I attended a French school for 5 years as a boy, and about two-thirds of what I now know, I didn't know 6 months ago, discovering how in what way Richard Nixon was a Quaker, and in what group within Quakerism he was raised. Seems to be the fact that fascinates most people that I've spoken to about this, and it certainly came as a surprise to me. I couldn't rationalize the spirit at the French school I attended with Richard Nixon.
What can you say about the Costa Rican colony of Quakers who I think went there after the First World War? What branch were they?
I don't know. I can find my reading and focus to North America per se and the and England as the root of all Quakerism. I was surprised to find that the Quaker population elsewhere in the English-speaking world, other than the United States and England, is rather sparse. Even in Scotland, Wales, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, they exist, but not in significant numbers. And I learned first about this Costa Rican group today, and when people were asking questions after I gave my talk.
And sister-in-law were in South Africa. He was in the diplomatic service, and she was active in the Quaker group in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They have missionaries there, though.
I don't know if these were missionaries. I think they were mostly people of English origin
mm-hmm.
who were really working hard to
yep.
improve the lot of the black people.
Yep. A couple of the things that I found, and one of the most interesting sources was a book. From England, contemporary writer, and it's intended for someone who has newly become a convinced Quaker in England to talk about how the matters operate and how they proceed. There's a lot of wonderful Quaker terminology. The expression that a certain statement or a certain value speaks to your condition. I learned that actually from a former Quaker who was a Universalist in Philadelphia many, many years ago. But I also learned that the Quakers apparently invented and have a specific meaning attached to the phrase, the sense of the meeting. Quakers are not democratic in the usual sense. In other words, decisions are not made by majority rule. Rather, they are made by the sense of the meeting, which means everyone who's entitled to be at the meeting needs to agree to whatever it is under discussion. It is possible for someone to stand aside, meaning I'm not going to oppose this, and in so doing the person is saying in effect, well, that's not how I would do it. But I don't see that as being, depending on whether they're theist or not, against God's will or improper. And so that's how decisions are made. But as long as there, it's sort of the only similar approach I'm aware of is the filibuster in the United States Senate. One person can hold matters up.
Like Scott Peck's consensus, the different drummer. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, in fact, that because the Quakers have so often been on the cutting edge of important social changes in favor of greater equality and a greater fairness, that it is probably from Quaker involvement in matters economic and political and social that the term, the sense of the meeting, has come into wider use, but it still has that very specific meaning within Quakerism. Correct.
For people to feel they reach the sense of it's not the same as consensus.
Absolutely not. And that is something that's useful and important to know. Not only in meetings for worship, if someone stands and speaks and then sits down, is there supposed to be a period of maintaining silence to, so everyone is reflecting on what was said, not responding to it immediately. Mm-hmm. I was told today by somebody who has been a Quaker that the same is used in the meetings for business. Once somebody makes a statement, he or she sits down and there's a moment to reflect on what was said. The idea is to avoid internal conflict. It may be, and this again is just speculation on my part, but the desire to avoid internal conflict is what gave impetus to the fact that there are these separate groups with different national organizations within Quakerism today, rather than a more unified a religious society of Friends that certainly existed prior to the 1820s here and has persisted in England.
Well, might that have been any group that's persecuted tends to close ranks.
Mm-hmm.
And be is much more of the same sense because they're all being persecuted.
Yeah.
Whereas once they're more tolerated, then they are individual difference.
Yeah. Right, it becomes less critical. Right, it's not life threatening to the life of the group or the organization. That I'm sure that that is the case. There's very little else that I can think to add to those basic topics.
I think there among some Native American tribes, there might have been decision-making procedures that are similar to what the Quakers call sense of the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. The Iroquois?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, a lot of these things aren't unique to the Quakers, but certain Quaker terminology
and the tradition.
I also like the concept that the term breaking meeting applies to the point at the end of especially a meeting for worship, when a person previously designated turns to someone and shakes hands with him or her. That's breaking meeting. In the absence of a recessional hymn with Anglican polyphonic music, you need something to determine.
Some coffee now,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the person who breaks the meeting is also the one who facilitates the remainder of the meeting, including organizing the announcements and so on. I inadvertently bumped into that when I was new to the meeting in Fort Collins. I thought that the time had run its course for silence, and I turned to the person next to me, and then everybody still continued with silence because they were waiting for me to stand up and conduct the rest of the meeting.
earlier.
Good thing you caught on.
Yeah. In the context of how much the Quakers have done to the American Friends Service Committee and its British counterpart, which had one name at the end of World War II but recently changed it, and I remember neither, is the story the Quakers like to tell about a stranger who comes to a meeting and sits down, and everybody in the room is seated silently, and he doesn't know what to make of this, and after 10 minutes, he just turns to the person next to him and whispers, "When will the service start?" And the Quaker smiles and says, oh, service starts after the meeting is concluded. which is, I think, lovely. So my basic message is, if you find that someone is a Quaker, that doesn't narrow down exactly where they are in the vast spectrum of theology and philosophy,
Correct.
I mean, you just assume that a group that small, half the size in North America of Unitarian Universalists, pretty small to begin with, are relatively unified in some major respects. But they function as groups beyond the monthly meeting in these different groups. I was also curious why it would be that the independents out in California in particular, but in that general neck of the woods, given their beliefs and their concerns and interests, wouldn't have affiliated with the Friends General Conference. There doesn't seem to be much difference to the uninformed observer between the two. And I drilled down a little bit and found that apparently they would like to be, this is probably a tradition that just hasn't been questioned, the glue that helps to bind together at some future date the other liberal Quakers and the Orthodox, so that there can be greater unity at some point. And that certainly makes sense to me. I don't know if that's exactly the case, but that's my understanding.
There's a smaller Quaker group in Madison that meets at the Wilmar Center. Mm-hmm. Do you know how they fit into the whole structure?
My understanding is that they are affiliated with the Friends United meeting. The so-called Orthodox Quakers. And when we're talking about liberal Quakers, that's capital L, capital Q. We're talking about the Orthodox Quakers, a little O. The Evangelicals, capital E, because that's right there in their name. I'm not certain whether that's a function of a high degree of theism, or whether it's just a historical accident, or precisely why. That is a matter of curiosity and interest to me. I've attended a couple of the Roberts Court meetings for worship, and have a better handle on who they are than the group over at Wilmar. I think that's a much smaller group. I think it's safe to say that because the one at Roberts Court is one of the larger Quaker meetings in North America.
Did Wilmar break off from Roberts, or did they come in as students from somewhere else?
I don't know.
Don, the Fort Collins monthly meeting, they were affiliated with a yearly meeting in the Southwest, weren't they?
Called Intermountain Yearly Meeting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, well, there's subgroups between monthly meetings and the national groups. There are quarterly meetings, there are annual meetings that are state-based or regional-based and this sort of thing. Friends General Conference and the Friends United Meeting and the Friends Evangelical Church International are functioning national bodies. I would think that the latter two, the FUM and the Evangelicals, are groups that have a little bit more top-down nature to them than Friends General Conference.
Well, is the General Conference at all like the UU Conference, where members from congregations all over the country go to the...
I believe so. Yeah, it's headquartered in Philadelphia, Its roots seem to be in the Hicksite and Wilburite traditions. There are different levels of participation that both individuals within a monthly meeting and monthly meetings within larger organizations seem to follow. I'm not all that knowledgeable on that.
If the friends make some kind of pronouncement about national or international affairs, does it come out of that friends conference?
It's more likely to come out of a group, and again, I believe it's the friends legislative conference.
I think I know a term that applies here. There's something called the Friends Conference on National Legislation.
That's the one I'm looking for, right. That's the group that's more, it's a politically progressive lobby group, basically. Things that come out of it, statements that come out of the Friends General Conference, sometimes do not sit well with more politically conservative Quakers who are more likely to be affiliated with the Friends United meeting or the evangelicals.
Do you know what kinds of things they've lobbied about?
I've been to their website, but I'll be happy to let it speak for itself. But if you have a pretty good idea what the average Jane County Democrat likes and dislikes, they would have similar concerns. Yeah, well, it's about national legislation, and it would be about oil dependency and human rights but a wide range of issues, not just what's best for Quakers. It's social issues.
I think they tend to focus at any given time on one issue or another, and maybe mm-hmm. on an annual basis they will announce mm-hmm. this is our focus.
Mm-hmm.
You just have pretty that kind of thing too, but I don't know if they will lobby.
This is literally a lobby.
Yeah.
People go to Washington, they meet with their...
And you have to register as such and file things as such, right?
You give money to them, it's not tax-deductible. Right. It's
not a religious country. Right. I also could mention, just to flesh out a little bit, the end of Quakerism that I've grown more knowledgeable about. In a French General Conference monthly meeting, one that's affiliated with it, and some of the other individual monthly meetings not affiliated with it, the meeting generates something called a statement of faith and practice. And in great detail, it specifies what matters of social and conscience, social concern and conscience, they are particularly concerned about. These come out of monthly meetings, and they will generate these. So someone who is new to the monthly meeting, someone who is a regular attender but not yet a member, can find out what their approach to various problems is and what has become historically in recent days the sense of the meeting in the sense of the congregation going forward. Those statements often include, it's sort of a user's manual in many respects, and will include sometimes a glossary of Quaker terminology, cautions about things that are not at all theological, but have to do with sort of the etiquette of how matters are run. And those are useful sources of information about any given Quaker monthly meeting in the sense of congregation.
The monthly meeting that I'm familiar with in Fort Collins, Colorado, is small. And so we don't create our own faith and practice mm-hmm. documentation, but we adopt mm-hmm. faith and practice from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a common practice because I think that meetings that don't have one or haven't addressed it in a long time will gather faith and practice books or manuals from other meetings, and maybe in the quarterly meeting that they're closest to, and do some cut and paste and adapting it. And frankly, speaking
of adapting, and what I was referring to is adopting it lock, stock, and barrel. Mm-hmm. Simply because if it's already there and it's what we feel mm-hmm. works for us, mm-hmm. then that's it.
Well, speaking as a retired attorney, lots of documents get created just that way. You start with somebody else's document. Mm-hmm. But I think that although initially they might just change, you know, XYZ city monthly meeting and just change that and then add their own, over time they're going to modify it according to the sense of their meeting and it will differ. But there's a great deal of commonality, certainly with respect to the so-called Quaker values, six in number in North America, four in England.
I wonder if there should be more active approach here in Madison between the Quakers and the UUs, that we have so much in common, mm-hmm. and yet you speak as if they're a foreign country.
Exactly. And that was part of my motivation for when I was asked, would you like to talk again?
What new suggestions do you have for how we could work?
My first suggestion you'll laugh at, but it's, you know, challenge them to a volleyball game. Get some interaction between the two groups. Encourage the kids in religious education in both groups to have some specific rate, you know, but it's going to be on the calendar every year. We're going to get together and do this. And so more social interaction. I mean, the object would not be to turn Unitarian Universalists or humanists into convinced Quakers or vice versa, but rather just to say, hey, you follow your way of meeting and worship, and this group follows a different way, but we're really very similar, even with like 100 members here and 200 members there, plus hangers-on like myself here and regular attenders who are not technically members there, neither of these is like critical mass.
What if there was a social justice issue we got together?
There are plenty of bases for doing it. My thought is that before you introduce a social justice issue, more interaction. Invite them over en masse, and see if we get invited back. But that was exactly my thought. The differences are stylistic, as far as I'm concerned, for the most part. And even though earlier it was stated that there's one and possibly two committed Christian theists on this side of the fence, and there are probably many more on theirs, I don't see that as being important. But I think before you put together a committee to do something, just getting the people together on some perfectly neutral basis would be how I would think it would be best to proceed.
You've actually been teaching in high school class, so that's a good group to
Do this. Mm-hmm. Well, that part of it started simply because one of the kids, there were like four or five, three of whom would be here on any Sunday, made a statement that I found surprising at the time, but it turns out is a widely held understanding among the average man on the street in America. And that was the statement, the Quakers. They're like the Amish, right? Well, they're both groups that originated in Europe and were pacifist and settled in Pennsylvania. But after that, there's not a whole bunch of
them.
Yes, they wore the same plain garb and they
Vietnam.
Found people using artificial makeup or...
Oh, they still did.
Decorating their clothes.
One of my fondest memories of the French school I attended was one of the girls in the class ahead of me. So this is like, oh, unapproachable adults, you know, because they're a year or two ahead of you, was the daughter of sort of spokesperson for the local Friends meeting. And she was not allowed to wear makeup, except when she appeared in the school production of The Mikado. But not just on a general basis. Yeah.
Well, they were called the plain folk.
Hmm?
Historically, they were the plain folk in
Pennsylvania. Right. But to a kid who's running around with a smartphone and has access to the internet to think that the Amish and the Quakers are interchangeable is
what you said
not
about
true.
Keeping up with the times compared to, that's totally opposite from the Amish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on the same subject, it's a subject of dismay to me that the Unitarian congregations in Madison almost seem to live in separate silos.
Well, they do. I don't think they kind of do. They do.
They do.
I've often thought that the Prairie, historically operating without a minister, was closer structurally to the Friends meeting than to the other two congregations.
Sure, but I think their substantive difference is, even if they're stylistic, I associate the First Unitarian Society more with like Sherwood Hills, and I associate James Reeb more with Willie Street, and these are, you know, local neighborhoods that have very definite and different flavors to them. I think Prairie serves a less well-defined, more eclectic community, less defined geographically, among other things. I think that it has continued.
More like the farming community.
More like what?
The farming community.
Well, I think Prairie has been. Prairie has served as a haven for UU misfits.
some would call those terms redundant.
When Karen Gustafson was at first, I would frequently vent to her about this subject. Why isn't first trying to enrich the smaller congregations in Madison instead of holding the roof? Because we lost several families to First Church. And it seemed to me if there had been a real welcoming attitude on both sides, that those families would have been able to be in the First Church choir and still be part of our community, but they didn't.
Well, my limited observation is that some of the people that have started at Prairie and gone on to First Unitarian Society were parents with kids of a certain age, and going to church on Saturday, which is offered there, did not conflict with soccer games, which apparently are held throughout the days on Sunday. And it's also true, and I was raised at a Unitarian church, a very, by Unitarian standards, conservative church, and the minister wore robes. The nature of that society was, if you weren't paying close attention, you'd think you were at Presbyterian service. Because there was a processional, it was all, you know, formal, and there was a printed order of service, and so on and so forth. The further away you get from New England in particular, but you can throw New York in, the less structured, less traditional Unitarians are. And I found, as my career, my spotty career took me various places around the country, that many Unitarian Universalist churches followed just if ever there was a Hicksite separation kind of thing within Unitarianism in particular, it was when the new hymnal came out. The old hymnal was the old Episcopal / Presbyterian hymnal with certain words changed so as not to be offensive to Unitarians. The new hymnal was something that I called, and I'm a product of New York City and a liberal college, for the birds and flowers people. It made, there was hymn after hymn that spoke in the most abstract terms. I didn't know what it was trying to say. And by the time I was in my 40s, I became an Episcopalian on the grounds that I'd rather filter Episcopalianism through a Unitarian brain and accept things as metaphor than go someplace which is in favor of good and truth in a very abstract sense. And there's nothing offensive that you'll find at a service at First Unitarian Society. My problem was finding substance in anything that was said in most of the sermons there. Once many years ago, when I was in law school, I went there, and there was a magnificent service given on the subject of how people, even passing in front of a church, are going to know whether they fit in there based on the sound that's coming out. Is there a lot of hallelujah? Is there a lot of formal music? Is it a guitar? That sermon was given by a local rabbi.
Was that pre or past Max?
Hmm?
Pre or past Max Gabler?
It was during his era. And it was a good friend of his who was the head of some local Jewish congregation. In the Vietnam era that I'm familiar with, if you didn't believe in God, you couldn't qualify as a conscientious objector, period. And even if you did, my understanding is that the draft boards that would interview people get to say, look, I don't want to carry a gun, I'm more than happy to be a medic. And the question is, well, isn't being a medic assisting the war effort? And if you're against war, why would you be willing to be a medic? And if you're not against war, then you don't get to be a conscientious objector. I mean, it was very... You know,
we had a couple.
That was different.
Very,
draft boards had different
policies. Yeah. Well, there's no draft today to provide a context for that.
We had a couple in Prairie who the man was a conscientious objector,
mm-hmm.
and became one of the people who subjected themselves to malaria testing.
Mm.
And then he had malaria.
Mm.
What is the
draft up and down? That was a printer for our.
Mm-hmm.
Of our schedules and cookbook and everything.
Mm-hmm. What's their name of the other very famous, terrible memory for names of things?
You're on thin ice asking
Ohio,
me.
Ohio, it's in Ohio, and it's the Quaker college. But it's
Earlham?
Not one of the ones you mentioned.
Earlham College?
No. Can you name a couple of others?
Antioch.
Had
a lot of Quakers. Well,
yeah,
Quaker.
Antioch.
Yeah. Strong
yeah.
Quaker.
Yeah. Anyway, Antioch is the one. That was the one that my family ended up going to college. Okay. And my father was a student there.
Mm-hmm.
When in the First World War, they formed a unit, a field hospital
mm-hmm.
unit,
yeah,
and sent them over to France in the First World War. And
I have a book at home that just came
that
out.
That was okay.
Mm-hmm. I have a book at home that just came out called, I believe it's called The Five Lieutenants, and it talks about five students at Harvard who graduate and enter World War I and were part of the first United States Army unit to fight in World War I, and one of those was a Quaker.
Hmm.
Talks about sending letters home to his aunt and addressing her as the in his letters.
They actually fought in infantry.
Yeah, he didn't make it out of the battle. The Quaker didn't, but neither did one of the other. I think it was three or four out of the five didn't make it through the war. But there was an interesting philosophical problem that I noticed just this last week in preparing for the talk I gave earlier, that didn't come out in questions. I was curious as to where the concept of the inward light originated, beyond being explained and framed by George Fox, and whether it was he who first used the expression, silly me to think so, this still small voice. And both are in the Bible. The light is from the book of John early on, I'm the light of the world. So it is Jesus as the light, and a piece of his light is in each of us. It was George Fox's idea. And the still small voice is what the bush that was burning but not consumed by flame did, smoke wind afterward, and I think it appears elsewhere as well. And it occurred to me that there's a logical circularity problem here, because we each have an inward light, and God can speak to us through a still small voice, then revelation is not confined to the Bible, because it's more immediate. We've got something more direct and more immediate, and therefore the Bible can be relegated to a secondary position, which was exactly what the Hicksites felt. But the authority for there being an inward light and certainly the still small voice is from the Bible.
No.
It's derived from the Bible, and on a basis of the derivation of the Bible, we interpret that the Bible is still revelation, but it's secondary to the immediacy of what's revealed to human hearts during a meeting for worship.
I think as a humanist, it comes from a conscience, don't you?
I'm willing to accept that, but I'm not willing to speak on behalf of George Fox along those lines, or even Elias Hicks.
Mm-hmm. Into the wilds of the West, mm-hmm. the Quakers were refusing to bear arms, and
right.
yet they were benefiting from the protection the other mm-hmm. settlers mm-hmm. provided to their settlements, and there was considerable resentment mm-hmm. In the communities there. The Quakers.
That's like people who benefit from the presence in the marketplace of unions, and their wages go up.
Right.
Yeah. There are elements like that. I mean, it's not the further into this, and it's not obviously just the Quakers, but the Quakers provide an interesting avenue into it. Discovering that, you know, Quakers fought among themselves. William Penn's sons were singularly not honest with the Native Americans. At one point, because he was running out of money, William Penn tried to sell the Pennsylvania colony back to England, and England would have none of it. And on and on, these, you know, the closer you get to it, the more just, you know, life it is.
I was wondering whether there was some record of how Quakers who were, say, on the edges of treaty areas, mm-hmm. how they treated the Indians when there was this push back over that again.
I think the Quaker impetus was always to be nice to everybody. When Pennsylvania was set up and included parts of what is now Delaware and part of the purview or part of the area of influence was on the eastern side of the Delaware River across from Philadelphia, Haddon Field, New Jersey, was named after a Quaker woman named Haddon, who established a farm there. Quaker women were amazingly independent, strong.
She was over there before it was actually...
Yeah, it was the Haddon family area, and they later named the town after her family name. But when they were colonizing, they weren't there, as the Puritans were, to bring in only their kind. They were bringing in Catholics who were still being persecuted mercilessly in England, and Methodists, and so on and so forth, you know, just folks from other denominations, and the Amish and the Mennonites and so on and so forth, as those groups came into being and needed a refuge. And But you find out that at one point, the people who were closest to the legacy of George Fox, who didn't die until 1691, were at odds on many issues with the followers of William Penn, who now had this all this land, and he had his own ideas with respect to theology. So it wasn't all quite as unified, and as I say, there were Quakers who owned slaves, I was telling people before, a piece that I didn't have any time for in my earlier talk involved a woman who was a Quaker, and she married a Quaker man, but he died. And her second husband was an Episcopalian. And we're talking the early 1800s, and he was from Virginia, and he owned slaves. And so when he died, she inherited his slaves. And as she went through life with her husband gone, she came more and more, became more and more frail, but also sunk more and more into poverty. And at one point, she sold one of her slaves, Paul Jennings was his name, to Daniel Webster. And Daniel Webster immediately told Jennings, you can work your way out of slavery. In other words, he immediately converted Jennings to an indentured servant. Jennings eventually did. While he was still in service to Webster, Webster would send him to go check up on the widow, see how she's doing, and if she needed anything, they would take things from the Webster household and just give them to her. And eventually, Paul Jennings earns his own freedom, pays off the indenture. He has his own house. Apparently, he was a gifted craftsman of some sort. And he keeps on doing this. He had been owned by this woman, but he is looking after her in her time of need absolutely spontaneously. So you have to figure that she was nice to at least one of her slaves. And you know this woman. This is Dolly Madison.
Oh. Interesting.
Isn't that cool?
I have occasionally heard people say that the really full name for the Quakers is the Society of the Friends of the Seekers of Truth. Did you encounter that at all?
Back in the days before the judge in Darby in 1650 slapped the generic term Quakers on George Fox and his followers, the Quakers had a number of different names, and that was probably one of the alternatives. They weren't exactly sure. But terms such as the Children of the Light, capital L, and the Friends of the Light, which is friends stuck and took off, were among the names. And it may have even varied somewhat regionally within England. Mm-hmm. I mean, the hotbed of Quakerism was in Lancashire and Cumbria, but it spread elsewhere.
Amazed by your figure of England having 1 in 100 the population were considered
right.
Quakers. Is that because the dissenters were sort of all lumped in together?
No, we're talking about actual Quakers. This is because, this is another thing about the Quakers. Early on, in the 1600s, the Quakers were Jehovah's Witnesses on steroids. They would enter in an Anglican church service in progress or one where the sermon is started and interrupt. And George Fox did this and many of the Quaker ministers. Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you go to Lancaster, you discover that one of the Anglican parish churches is across a plaza about twice the size of this room. And on the other side of the plaza are the back doors to Lancaster Castle. And it was through those doors and down some stairs that the oldest cells, where certainly the Quakers must have been held, are. And now you can just imagine one of these guys being dragged in his plain garments with his heels scraping, from one building to the other. Yeah, no, they were vociferous early on. They were very little evangelical. I was went to great pains to say proselytizing rather than evangelizing earlier, but that's what they were up to. And it was these outbursts, as much as any religious fervor, that caused the label of Quaker to be applied to lots of little groups, but it stuck with it.
How does Quaker have to do with, how does that name come to be applied?
It was, with respect to the Religious Society of Friends, it apparently was a phenomenon early on that before someone stood to speak in meeting, the person would physically quake. I would personally suspect this is related to the psychology behind speaking in tongues. Mm. But you have to remember, this is not the social elite we're talking about.
So it was nerve-wracking to do that.
I don't know if it was nerve-wracking or whether it was perceived as part of who you're supposed to be, as it would be today and at a church where there is speaking in tongues and that sort of thing. As with any research project, you wind up with more questions than you started with. I would occasionally have something that I, simple declarative sentence, and say, is that true? And it was that way that I discovered that William Penn spent a total of max 6 years in North America. He spent his life in England. He was English. Just, that's the way it was. Mm-hmm.
Well, Ken, you're going to have to benefit us with something.
I'm running out of research projects.
This is not the most after research.